Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. Plan out to have a look at religion around the world. We'll start in our own backyard. Good to welcome Stephen Crittenden.
Hello, John.
Stephen, good to have you with us again. A couple of interesting stories this week. The Catholic Church, of course, around the nation, have been testing out a new liturgy. This is a change from the liturgy that was introduced way back with Vatican II when the Mass became English and everybody could have it in the vernacular. Over the last year or so, the Vatican, or last several years, the Vatican have been revising it, and the new English translation is being tested on the parishes.
Mm. It's actually too early, I think, to tell what the response is going to be. I suspect Australian Catholics are going to have a typical kind of low-key Australian passive-aggressive approach. They'll grumble a lot, but in the end they might go quiet.
Yes, we should say there has been a little rumbling about this amongst those who are most concerned with the translation, although you wouldn't have got that impression from the article in The Australian.
No, Tess Livingston, the journalist based in Brisbane, the Catholic journalist who writes on religion a lot for The Australian, of course Cardinal Pell's biographer, creating, I think, a somewhat misleading account of the true picture in suggesting that everyone's very happy with it. The headline of her article captures it, "New Translation of Liturgy Launched to Mass Applause." I think it's far too early to say that, and I think it doesn't catch the truth of the fact that probably large majority of Vatican II priests who are in their 60s now are pretty troubled by the new translation and the way it's come about. I mean, don't forget, this is a process that's really been going on since about 1997, and it undermined processes of consultation with liturgists in the Catholic Church all around the world that had been going on for 30 years.
And the concern of those liturgists, as I take it, is both based in two areas. One, that the style of the language itself is not comfortable contemporary English, and that in searching for more accurate, doctrinally orthodox expressions, they've lost contact with the way real people talk. And the other thing is that the search for more doctrinally accurate has led to an older vision of what the priesthood and Catholicism is about.
I don't think, on the second point, I don't think there's any doubt, reading through the minutiae of the translation, the new translation, that what it is really about is the revival of a traditionalist ideology, if you like, of the Catholic priest as a sacred person, and of the congregation almost like supplicants in a kingly court in the language that they use to pray to God. And of course, that's the language that really continued, I suppose, from the 16th century on right up to the 1960s.
So there are real theological implications.
I think there are. That's right. The other thing to say, just on the first point you were making about the departure from kind of what the congregation knows and understands, the Australian newspaper itself actually gave a very helpful example. They sat two pieces of the liturgy from the Creed side by side, and I'll just read one sentence to you. This is from the Creed: "God from God, Light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, one being with the Father." That's the translation the Church has had since the late 60s. That's been changed to "God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, consubstantial with the Father." Now,
there's a word that needs some unpacking.
It certainly does, and it had actually been unpacked to some extent in the 1969 translation. I wonder how many Catholics in Australia these days understand what consubstantial means. We're talking about the revival of a whole lot of effectively ancient Greek, Aristotelian, Platonic, philosophical concepts.
Arguments about substance and essence and all of those sorts of things, which you have to know a fair bit to know exactly what the implications of that are.
Indeed, and they may actually accurately capture what the Church in fact believes. Mm-hmm. But if you don't understand those terms, if you don't understand that terminology in the pews, then it's hard to say that you believe it.
Shall we move on?
Indeed.
There's another matter which is as raising a few eyebrows among a sort of theologically literate people this week, and that is a statement by Peter Jensen. Peter Jensen, the Anglican Archbishop of Sydney, has endorsed a statement which has come out from the Australian Christian Lobby, which is a lobby group run and, I guess, essentially controlled by former SAS Brigadier Jim Wallace in Canberra. And this one goes to the question of the changes proposed to the Marriage Act.
Indeed, and I guess the comments were made about this time last weekend, and caused a furore in the press when Peter Jensen talked about gay marriage potentially causing polygamy and incest. I think the thing to say about that is that clangs a rather odd bell for Peter Jensen. It sounds an unusually off note. Peter Jensen hasn't tended to speak in that kind of language. I mean, he hasn't tended to insult his enemies in quite that way. He's had a more sophisticated approach. Even though he might disagree with gay marriage, he hasn't talked in that kind of language. And I would say that this actually is related to the fact that you're seeing the Sydney Anglicans and the Sydney Catholics and several other churches effectively outsourcing their social policy here to Jim Wallace and the Australian Christian Lobby. This isn't the church's language, this is the Australian Christian Lobby's language. And in fact, the pamphlets that have been written and endorsed by the churches give the churches all kinds of lines and arguments that they might care to use.
There are several really interesting things that are raised by this. The first question is, why would church leaders, some church leaders, one should say, rely on Jim Wallace and the ACL and their traditionally conservative statements on this issue rather than go through their existing church theological and social policy bodies, which all of them have? Is it because perhaps they were aware that most theologians and policy committees these days are much more nuanced about the way they'd address an issue such as this?
And it might well be, for example, that the official Catholic position is to oppose gay marriage, and the official Anglican position actually for the National Anglican Church may be somewhat more complex, and the Uniting Church more complex still. Very difficult under those circumstances to run a policy like this or a campaign document like this through the existing processes, say, of the National Council of Churches.
Yes, why wasn't the National Council of Churches the body through which such a document exists?
It may well not have got up.
Yes, because it doesn't reflect the diversity of opinion or informed opinion within the churches.
Indeed, but so what you're seeing here is you're seeing a number of individuals connected with fairly conservative strands within their own church traditions almost walking away from
Their existing structures.
The structures of mainstream Christendom in this country, if you like, to walk over to the margins, if you like, to a group that's really a fairly extreme lobby group. A political lobby group, really, isn't it? The Australian Christian Lobby.
Well, that's what it describes itself as. Do they risk something else here, making themselves hostages to fortune, in a sense, in that the ACL, the Australian Christian Lobby, is not a group that any of these groups can control, yet here they're allowing the ACL to be their spokesman effectively and mount the campaign on their behalf on an issue that for many in the church is something that they'd want to be fairly careful about how it was expressed.
I think the issue, and we've mentioned this on several occasions over the years, John, that who are the Australian Christian Lobby? They're not a church. Who does Jim Wallace speak for? And in the past, on similar issues, you would expect the Catholic Church or the Anglican Church to speak for itself. But here, that isn't what's happening. And I think the potential is there for when the churches come out on these sorts of issues, they actually lend their imprimatur to the Australian Christian Lobby, and they promote Jim Wallace in the end as much as the issue that they're talking about.
Promoting over their own bodies.
Over their own bodies. That's the point.
Yes. We might leave that one there because there is another issue that I'd like to address. We've only got limited time, another couple of issues actually. One, let's move out of Australia for the moment. This week in Jakarta, Abu Bakar Bashir, the radical Islamist, has been sentenced to 15 years jail. But it's a very interesting commentary by the ABC's representative in Jakarta about whether or not this is, well, what the implications of this are for good or ill.
Yes, well, I had dinner with Matt Brown, the Jakarta correspondent for the ABC, who was in Sydney with his wife, Toni O'Loughlin, who writes for The Guardian and Haaretz and other newspapers. And they were talking about the social situation in Indonesia as they saw it. But before we get to that, Matt appeared on last Thursday night after the sentencing of Abu Bakar Bashir and made, I think, a very important point, which is worth repeating. And that is that because of the way the Indonesian jail system operates, and we know this from several Australian drug runners who've found themselves in jail, there's a kind of a permeable kind of layer around the Indonesian jail system. And just because Abu Bakar Bashir is in jail, in prison, doesn't mean that he won't be able to recruit within the prison system. And he may even be able to preach. There is a lot of coming and going in the prison system in Indonesia.
And in fact, the prison system provides almost a closed network.
Well, certainly a closed network, perhaps a somewhat more open network as well. In other words, the fact that Abu Bakar...
Or a secure network, I should say.
The fact that he's behind bars doesn't mean that he's going to be slowed down in any way. That's, I think, a very important point to make. The other thing that I was just going to raise is that both Matt and Toni made the point to me that in their time in Indonesia, they've been struck by the increasing Arabization of Islam in Indonesia, as represented by someone like Abu Bakar Bashir, who's, of course, of Yemeni background. This has been going on slowly for more than a century.
Yes, we need to make the case that Islam came to Indonesia in the last 500 or 600 years, that it became embedded in the Indonesian cultural system, and it was some way influenced by the previous Hindu and animist traditions of Indonesia.
Traditions
it became its own sort of Islam.
Indeed, those traditions have proved to be very resilient, and so you got a very interesting hybrid kind of easygoing, I think you'd be truthful to say, mix in Indonesia. Now, there's no doubt that on the ground, and I'm not suggesting that the majority of Indonesian Muslims are followers of Abu Bakar Bashir, they're not, but there is a growing conservatism. Now, Toni O'Loughlin's just written a piece for Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, a long article talking about the very shocking, in her view, level of anti-Semitism in ordinary political and social discourse in Indonesia, which is something I think that most Australians would be unaware of. She says it's off the Geiger counter.
And she's suggesting it's coming out of this Arabization of Indonesian Islam.
Particularly coming out of that.
And this is at the grassroots
It's at the grassroots level. And she was telling me, interestingly, that they have a friend in Jakarta who's a Hasidic Jew who dresses in all the Hasidic gear, who laughs and says, "They don't know I'm a Jew. They wouldn't know a Jew if they fell over one." But that doesn't stop the fact that there is very strong anti-Jewish rhetoric in ordinary public discourse in Indonesia.
Well, yes, and I guess it's an easy one to construct when your enemy is a myth, isn't it?
That's right.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, has been a very interesting... Well, his tenure in the position has been a very interesting one, in that he's had to deal with huge battles within the Anglican Communion, trying to keep it together over some of the issues we've been talking about, but also a sea change in British society itself. And this week in The New Statesman, he's addressed some of those issues.
Well, it's a very interesting issue of The New Statesman, which is a pretty good magazine, and it's devoted an entire issue to different aspects of religion. And he's written the editorial, and he's really on form in this editorial. And what he's talking about in particular is the debates that are really going on very fiercely in Britain at the moment under the new Conservative government, the Cameron government. And this is Cameron's idea of the big society.
This is the idea about outsourcing many of the sort of social policy programs of government to local communities. The question of how those local communities then resource them is said to be in the hands of voluntary movements.
And charities and churches. So in a sense, there's a push to return to the kind of 19th century charitable model that Dickens, for example, is critiquing in his novels as being wholly inadequate. And Rowan Williams is making the point that, first of all, that he says government badly needs to hear in the UK just how much plain fear there is around these questions. It isn't enough to respond, he says, with what sounds like a mixture of this is the last government's legacy and we'd like to do more, but just wait until the economy recovers a bit. They really have to understand how concerned people are and how many people are going to be affected by this. So that's the first point. But he's also making the point that there are problems with the model that we're talking about, this outsourcing of welfare model. And he says, the uncomfortable truth is that while grassroots initiatives and local mutualism, that's the term that's being used, are to be found flourishing in a great many places in Britain, they've been weakened by several decades of cultural fragmentation. The old syndicalist and cooperative traditions cannot be reinvented overnight, and in some areas they have to be invented for the first time.
Well, in fact, one could argue that the whole thrust of the last 30 years, of particularly through commercial media, has been towards constructing the atomised individual as the only actor, and that those communitarian traditions have no place in a modern society.
This is Margaret Thatcher's "there is no such thing as society" philosophy, which has been so effective beyond Britain's shores, of course. It's just very interesting that here you've got the leader of the largest, the established church in the United Kingdom, raising concerns that we actually may not be all that happy about being part of this picture that you're talking about, and picking up where government would like to be able to leave off.
There's a continuing pressure, of course, for those sort of issues to flow over into countries such as Australia, because we've been subject to the same sort of change. It leads one to the sort of idle speculation that at some point we're going to have to make a decision as a society, as a community, as to whether or not the philosophy we share about the individual being the key to things, and therefore the limitation of taxation on the individual, and the contradiction that brings up, because as individuals we want more services yet expect to pay less for them. And sooner or later,
well, this debate, of course, is happening in the United States at the moment, yes, where anything is allowed to be talked of. Barack Obama is now even talking about cutting defence spending, but the one thing you can't talk about is raising taxes to provide any of these welfare services. I think it's fairly true to say that how this debate plays out in Britain is going to be very important here, further down the track in Australia. These influences flow in our direction, and we're probably not paying enough attention to these welfare debates that are swirling around in the UK at the moment.
Where goes the good society? Stephen Crittenden, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.